Juliet Dogcast Radio. If you like dogs, wherever you are in the world, we're the show for you. Hello and welcome to episode 48 of Dogcast Radio. It's our second birthday show, and to celebrate, we had a day out at the Train and Behave finale, where we interviewed Dr. Roger Mugford.
It provides an insight into the incredible sensory differences or the tiny subtle cues that dogs are capable of detecting, and they don't acquire that by training, they acquire that just by birth and being around humans. They're studying us, they're responding to little micro cues of our body gestures, of our voice, the tone of our voice, the gravel of our voice, the tension, who knows, the smell of our bodies from emotional states. And that's what makes dogs such incredible companions, that they are very, very perceptive.
We also discovered some fantastic ideas from author Jason Rich on how to pamper your dog.
The whole focus of the book is how to pamper your dog and give him the best of everything, but everything that's in his best interest and in that for the health and well-being of the dog, not necessarily the owner.
And we met up with Stephen Palm from Hound TV.
Well, this is a great thrill, Julie. This is certainly the furthest we've been on official Hound TV duty. So, what is it, 20,000 miles or something? So
It's above and beyond the call of duty, really, isn't it? But it's nice to actually meet you finally.
It's great. It's great.
But we start our show with something I've been longing to see for myself, the latest dog activity to come to the UK, jetty dogs. Penny Draper and her dog represented Britain in America at the Jetty Dog Championships, and she was at Train and Behave giving people, and dogs, the chance to have a go.
Yes, have a go. Well, a full competition.
Oh, right,
plus have a go.
Yeah.
So we've run three waves, which are what the Americans call heats.
Mm.
They keep all the words watery.
Mm.
So we ran three waves. The last one had 25 dogs in it, which was really good.
Excellent.
And then the final of 12, the best 12 go forward into the final.
Yeah.
And they compete for a trophy and...
Yeah.
It's not there now. No. I don't know why I'm waving at it. And also people just could come out of... And give it a go.
Mm.
Some of those people ended up in the final, and some of them couldn't get their dogs up the steps.
Aww.
So, you know, it was...
Yeah.
It was a...
Yeah. Now, what's the aim with jetty dogs? What do the dogs actually do?
Basically, it's long jump for dogs, except that they jump into water. And that's the bit... Well, certainly my Jack likes the water bit. Others do it because they're chasing a toy. And we measure... from the end of the jetty as to the dog's bottom, so to speak, and that length is you know, their long jump.
Yeah.
And the world record is actually 28'10".
Wow.
Which is huge.
Yeah.
Huge.
Good grief. And that's a greyhound, isn't it?
That's a greyhound called Country. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, I met him when I was over in America last week.
Yeah.
And our personal best is 16'7".
Mm.
So...
That's not to be sneezed at, is it? That's...
Well, it's a long way, actually.
Yeah.
It's as long as my lounge.
Yes, when you think of it like that.
Yes.
Because you were out in America representing Great Britain, weren't
you? I was, yes. That was a real honour and very exciting, although the travelling with a dog is quite stressful.
Yeah.
He wasn't stressed.
Mm.
It was me.
Yes.
But we went over there. We jumped in the World Championships.
Yeah.
There were representatives from three countries there so far. We're working on Spain and Italy at the moment, I think, next.
Yeah.
And got to meet all the big jumping dogs, Country and one or two others.
Yeah.
And it was very, very exciting. They jumped actually into natural water.
Oh, wow.
So it was a natural lake.
Yeah.
With a jetty just built out into it.
Mm-hmm.
Which was interesting because Jack loves natural water and that's how I train him.
Or
condition him, shall I say. I take him twice a week and swim him quite hard for about 25 minutes.
Yeah.
So he's just used to swimming.
Mm.
So he jumped in and swam off. In the end, they got two or three of the staff members in the water and swimming out for him. The crowd loved it.
I bet.
They loved it. And, of course, he wasn't the biggest jumping dog, but he was the one that they all remembered. So that was quite fun.
So tell us a bit about Jumping Jack Splash.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
Yes.
So what breed is he?
He's a flat-coated retriever, a black one. Black-coated retriever. perhaps a little small for his breed if you're looking at showing. But he's 7.5 years old. Still thinks he's 7.5 months. he's tried most things in his life. He's sort of half managed obedience and half managed agility, half managed heel work to music, and then he discovered this.
Yeah, and this is his forte.
Well, you just got to see their face and feel them quivering at the end of the lead when they want to get in there. When you're doing something they really love, then you know it.
Yeah.
He's dragged me up those steps 2 or 3 times on my stomach trying to get into the water. But he's getting it now and he's learning.
Oh. It's interesting when you see the different dogs' reactions, because as you say, some of them just leap in there, no fear, and that's it.
Yeah.
Others of them sort of teeter down the exit, you know, that ramp.
Yes.
And some of them, bless them, they were so funny because they were sort of standing on and teetering.
Rocking, yes.
And whining, and you could see them thinking, I want to, no I don't, I want to, no.
Yes.
So, you know, what is Jetty Dogs, what's the attitude to that? You know, how much can you encourage your dog?
We would say you could encourage them as much as you like. Mm. And I mean, even as a judge, I was splashing the water to make them see that there was something there to jump into, because it's actually quite a big drop. It's 2 foot down into the water, and some of them find that quite daunting.
Mm.
Plus it's bright blue water, which, you know, they like dirty water. But the attitude is that once you've got them on the dock, you mustn't push, shove, kick or otherwise get them into the water if they don't want to go.
No.
If they want to teeter on the edge, and you can stand there as long as you like and keep trying.
Yeah.
But if they don't want to go in at that point, then it's best to withdraw.
Yeah.
And perhaps next time you come, they'll have got a bit more courage and they'll have a go.
Yeah.
Especially if they stand and watch the other dogs.
Yes.
That really helps, you find. But we don't allow any hands-on.
No.
Once they're on that dock. A dog should do something like this because they love doing it, or because they love you. One or the other, or both, preferably.
Yeah.
But not because somebody just wants to win prizes.
No. I mean, as you say, it's quite clear, the ones that love it and the ones... I mean, we've got 2 labs. They'll paddle.
Yeah.
Neither of them would jump into water. Not by choice.
And I've got 2 Tavurans, both of whom will paddle. One will go up to a chest and one will go up to a knees.
Yeah.
And he has jumped since he was 6 months old just because he wanted to.
Yeah.
And then you find a sport that takes advantage of that. What more can you want?
I know. So if someone's looking to sort of, you know, if they've got a dog that enjoys the water, or perhaps they want to find out if their dog would enjoy this, you know, you can go along and there's not going to be any pressure.
The
dog can do it or...
Or not.
Yeah.
That's right. And we give as much help as we can.
Mm.
Obviously, our time is limited because there's a queue of people all waiting to go in too. But if the dog looks as if it's going to jump, then we wait a bit longer. But if it doesn't, then we'll say, go and join the end of the queue, come back in a little while and see if they will. And some of the people that were in the finals today, this is their second time of coming, and the first time they didn't jump. So, you know, that's nice to see.
Yeah.
And there was also 2 puppies there that have never jumped before.
Yeah.
And, okay, they didn't jump far. They jumped 3 foot.
Yeah.
But they jumped in.
Yes.
That was the main thing. And they liked doing it. Nobody sort of said, you've got to.
No.
They did it because they wanted to.
How young can dogs start doing this?
We won't let them start at all until they're 6 months old. We're still in discussions as to whether it should be 6 months or 12 months. But we think because of the soft landing in water...
Well, this is it. There's no jarring.
And because it's not repetitive like agility.
Yeah.
And it's not twisting and turning like heel work to music. It's just jump in if you want to. And that seems to work quite well at the moment. We're still working on it. In America, that's their rules, and we're still adjusting ours to suit.
Yeah. The biggest problem with some of them seem to be getting them back out again after they jumped in.
Yes. Yes. It's quite good if you've done a little bit of obedience first. And the idea of actually retrieving something can be quite good.
Yes.
But some of them, particularly a day like today where it was so hot...
Yeah.
You can't really blame them for wanting to swim round and do a lap. Jack always used to do a lap. He'd leap out, grab the toy and do a lap and look at all the people.
Oh, like our Tiger.
Yeah.
Yeah. And is there a website that we can link to?
The website at the moment is www.eastmidlandsjettydogs, all one word, .co.uk. There will be a jettydogs.com, but that hasn't been developed yet. So although it says East Midlands, it actually covers the whole country. We're the ones that are running it.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting to go on to docdogs.com, which is the American version. There's a big forum on that and lots of chat.
Mm.
So that's interesting to see, because they talk about training tips and all the things that, you know.
Jetty Dogs look like it's great fun if you have a dog that likes water, and it definitely makes excellent viewing. Just watch out for the splashes they go in and the shakers they get out. We've linked to both the sites Penny mentioned. Also at Train and Behave, we met Claire Guest, who was promoting a new UK charity that will help both people and dogs, Cancer Dogs UK.
Well, it's a new idea, really, but it's come from stories all over the world. I'm sure you've heard that dogs are warning their owners about cancers, particularly malignant melanomas. So there have been stories about dogs that persistently nibble or scratch or whine at a sort of mole that appears to be perfectly normal on somebody's body, and they go to the doctor and they find out that it's a malignant melanoma. So about 5 years ago, I started working with Dr. Church and Amersham Hospital, which is part of the Bucks NHS Trust, to do the first study to find out whether or not dogs could be trained to do this. So we started with bladder cancer, the idea being that you could give the dogs the urine sample and see whether the dogs were able to detect these tiny cells or volatiles from the tumour. And they were able to do it. So we had it published in the British Medical Journal, worked with the researchers, and it was the first time in the world that there'd ever been a study that actually proved that dogs were able to do this. So the door is now open, really, and I've decided very recently to dedicate my time full-time to this project, and we're actually starting a research charity. So I'm working at the moment with Amaderm. Amaderm is a charity that works looking at skin disease and cancer, and we're looking to raise funds in order that we can train a team of dogs so they'll hopefully be able to work with the doctors and teach us more about cancer and hopefully save lives, dogs' lives and human lives. So obviously if we can understand more about what cancer does and how, you know, how it can be detected and diagnosed, then it's good news for everybody, really.
Yeah. And as you say, sort of find out what it is the dogs are detecting.
Exactly. I mean, it seems it isn't easy for the dogs, which tends to indicate that it's a very tiny amount. I mean, I suppose if you think about it logically, if you had unlucky enough to have a tumour in your bladder, that tumour would drop small numbers of cells into your urine sample. The dog would then smell a very small part of the urine sample, and what he's detecting is volatiles from those cells. So we're talking about tiny amounts, and they don't find it easy. You have to train the dogs over a long period of time and work very closely with the dogs, which is why I really felt that I needed to dedicate my time to this project, that it needed my full attention, really. So it's sort of exciting times, but frightening times too, because I've got six dogs I'm working with, and we're looking really for any sort of help, financial help. We're also looking for premises, because we need at the moment I train at home, but we actually need premises in the Bucks area that is cool, because what we find is if the samples heat up too quickly, the volatiles seem to go disappear because they're very light molecules. So we need a cool environment where the dogs don't pant. So it's exciting times. But we're also looking at other diseases. For example, some of the dogs don't do well as cancer dogs because they get too set on finding blood, and cancer dogs have to ignore blood because ultimately blood is not necessarily an indication of cancer. So what we're thinking of doing is actually changing those dogs to blood detection dogs. So there'll be dogs which actually be able to detect blood, which has a whole range of other interests. So it's a fantastic, exciting project. So any support is...
Okay, brilliant.
A very worthwhile project, and one we hope to keep in touch with. If you'd like to find out more, we've linked to the Amaderm site.
You're listening to Dogcast Radio on www.dogcastradio.com.
The Train and Behave finale day was such an enjoyable day, with so many interesting things going on and with such a positive central message. The following day, once everything had calmed down, we were lucky enough to have time to talk to Train and Behave originator, renowned animal psychologist Dr. Roger Mugford. I wanted to know just what inspired Train and Behave Week.
Well, we've been really depressed in 2006 at a number of serious incidents, two of them fatal, involving dogs attacking children. One, if you recall, was over a pub in Leicester, and I was involved in the forensic follow-up on that incident, and it was just outrageous. Two dogs that never had a life were locked on the roof of a pub and eventually got into the family rooms and killed a child. And the other was a pit bull used as a protection dog in Merseyside, Liverpool. And again, that person shouldn't have had that dog. But arising from those stories, again, politicians were saying, should we not have more coercive legislation that deals with dogs in homes that are dangerously out of control, not just dogs in public places, which is where the Dangerous Dogs Act stops. Mm. And, of course, the thought of more legislation just horrifies me. And the natural inclination of the press, Fleet Street, and I'm not blaming them for it, is that bad news is much more newsworthy than good news. Yeah. So I just want to keep the bad news off the headlines, or out of the tabloids. And the way to do that is to have dogs better controlled, owners better educated. Dogs that, as puppies, are better socialised. Dogs that are bred for better, more, if you like, homely, petly, pet-oriented characteristics. And I want to see the world of dog ownership really improved and become more sophisticated, as it is and has happened in the 30 years or more that I've been working in this field. You know, I've seen big improvements, major improvements, with particularly the introduction of puppy schools, socialisation classes, that is entirely the idea and inspiration of Ian Dunbar, an American-British veterinarian. So, things are getting better. There's so much good news, and there are all these animal behaviourists stroke dog trainers. Now, I started the whole animal therapy movement 27 years ago, so I thought, as the sort of grandfather of the area, I should show a bit of leadership, and we should get people pulling in the same direction, providing free, in this week that we've just had, free consultation and training, initial training of dogs to people who wouldn't normally go anywhere near a trainer or a behaviour therapist, and that's been the outcome. We've had 300-400 trainers, behaviourists log on to our website, and we've had other shows around the UK than this one here in Chertsey, Surrey, which are celebrating the end, the Saturday, the end of Train and Behave Week. We've had lots of great PR publicity, radio, print and so on, and not much mainstream TV, because again, TV deals like to deal with disasters, not with good news. But next year, I'm sure we'll do the same again, because I saw that people were overwhelmingly happy yesterday, and
we want that to day.
It's a great day. We had especially good support from the major charities like the Blue Cross and Battersea and the Hearing Dogs for the Deaf. I'm very fond of the charities that help people by training specialist dogs in detection or guide. And they were well represented. All the money that we made from the whole week will go towards those major charities. I think everybody appreciates it.
Yeah. I think as well, when you're talking about training, when you sit and watch those, I mean, yesterday, as you say, the Dogs for the Deaf, what they can train them to do, and how finely they can train them. You know, you hear this noise and you lie down, you hear this noise and you do this, you know, and to alert. And you can think, wow, if, you know, I should be able to get my dog to a fairly basic, you know, level of obedience.
Well, it provides an insight into the incredible sensory differences, or the tiny subtle cues that dogs are capable of detecting, and they don't acquire that by training, they acquire that just by birth and being around humans. Yeah. They're studying us, they're responding to little micro cues of our body gestures, of our voice, the tone of our voice, the gravel of our voice, the tension, who knows, the smell of our bodies from emotional states. And that's what makes dogs such incredible companions, that they are very, very perceptive, much more than humans. And you see in their social interactions, play and so on, that they're so much faster than humans. You know, they're the supreme Muhammad Ali type boxers in terms of reflexes. So, clever dogs doing clever things for these assistance roles. They are exactly the same dogs that are really our pets and companions, and being used to keep our feet warm and go to bed with us. So really, it's an inspiration to ordinary owners to do more with their dogs, yeah. I hope.
I think the nice thing that was there, you catered for so many different... we do have dogs around us, as you can hear. You catered for so many different levels of ability and experience, you know, young dogs, young handlers, right up to sort of the more advanced. So wherever you were already, you had that encouragement to... Yeah. Take it a bit further or start off, you know?
Yeah. To be fair, there are most exemption shows around the country, and every weekend there's one somewhere, and the posher shows too. They provide those different levels. So if people want to get involved and do things at the weekend with their dogs, maybe go to agility, hear what to music and so on, go to, on tracking courses where dogs can be taught to, you know, locate objects. All these sports, if you like, are available to people. So what we did isn't especially unique, but what we did was we got such a diversity of national bodies together pulling all in the same direction. And, of course, the big thing, the big pull for many of us as it was a scorching hot day, was to jump in the pool. So we brought over what's called jetty dogs from America. And so a socking great 100,000-litre swimming pool with... dogs encouraged and sometimes refusing to jump off a jetty and as far as they could, and I gather the furthest jump was an incredible 19 feet. Sorry, we're not metric, and that is quite a distance really for a dog that came to it untrained. And in America I think the world record stands at 27 feet, so 19 feet from for a pure beginner here in a little old England, was pretty good.
Yes, yeah. That was so funny to watch. I mean, the ones that, the dogs that did it sort of, well, that was a pleasure to watch. But it was also the ones that teetered on the edge and sort of, oh, I'm not sure. And the ones that cheated and worked out they could actually go down the ramp. They didn't have to jump in. And then the ones that sort of went in and said, I'm not coming out now. And that was brilliant. That was fun, wasn't it? That was really fun.
You will have noticed that my girlfriend's dog, Harry, was one of those that cheated down the ramp. He's 10, 11 years old, we don't know. He's an ex Dogs Trust dog of about a year standing. And he just was in heaven, you know. He's a dog with joint pain, as befits his age. And all the weight taken off his joints, of course, in water, he suddenly reached his perfect environment. So it's good for dogs, and it's a soft landing when they jump, and it's a heck of a lot of fun.
Yeah. Yeah. So when you're not organising Trainer Behave Week, you run Company of Animals.
Well, I probably run it very badly. In fact, I've got a great team of about 20 plus around me, headed by a chap called Steve Driver. And he must take a lot of the credit for the day-to-day running of the company. You know, I do just do the big things like the design of different products, new products. And we're launching and designing new stuff all the time. And I suppose the strategic direction which we want to go, which is world conquest. We want to, we're so well received and well positioned in the UK that, and any trainer who's doing anything with dogs is likely to be using our equipment, that we're trying to repeat the same success in other countries. So that's our big activity. But we retain the small time philosophy that we had when I started this company 24 years ago, which is that we won't touch anything that doesn't somehow benefit dogs and indirectly, obviously, benefit, help owners. But animal welfare is the first priority, before profit or anything like that.
And so sort of owners that have problems can actually come here, they're referred to you, are they, or they visit you and then they get the help and support they need?
Yes, there are two strands, perhaps three strands to my life here. One is I'm a simple farmer, and I do keep sheep and cattle that you know you're not going to see today because they're hidden away because of the foot and mouth crisis just down the road, only 20 kilometres away in Guildford, and the exclusion zone is 10 kilometres. So we're very lucky to be just on the edge of that, or unlucky. So I love the farm because it's a change from people and pets, and I need that. And as you can see, I've got my hay to save today, get the bales in. But then the second is the Animal Behaviour Centre, which is where it all started. And 27 years ago, I was a scientist in industry looking at dog behaviour from a very academic, research, scientific point of view, and got interested in applying our knowledge of the human-animal bond, what people need from living with their pets, and what they benefit from, or how they benefit from living with their pets, and overcoming some of the problems that people have with their pets. And so I started the notion of therapy for, or behaviour modification for problematic pets, usually dogs, but cats and horses as well. And so that continues to be a major area of employment for my colleagues. I've got 7 colleagues in the practice, and usually, and it should be a vet as well, but at the moment my daughter, a vet, is in training, should we say, and we will have others join us, and I've had many vets come through for training purposes, but it's a veterinary oriented referral practice, by vets for vets ideally, but we run training classes, agility tracking courses, we lecture to vet nurses because I'm very keen to improve the standard of behavioural care welfare husbandry within vet practices, because surprise, surprise, lots of dogs are really stressed when they go to the vets. It's seen as, well, it would be, it's as unpleasant as going to the dentist.
Oh, yeah.
Look how patient-friendly dentistry has become, pain-free dentistry. Well, we want pain-free and welfare-oriented, fun-oriented veterinary practice. So that's a major area for me and a colleague, a veterinarian, called Kendall Shepherd, and we're writing a book on the subject. But so that's the Animal Behaviour Centre, and it's a really active area. It doesn't actually make any money. It's a labour of love. Anyone who thinks that there's money to be made doing behaviour modification specialist one-to-one therapy, forget it. There ain't. It's very time-consuming, extremely, incredibly rewarding, because you are helping people, and there's nothing better than that. But it won't make money, and it won't pay the mortgage. What does pay the mortgage for me is the company of animals, and that obviously has become quite a big concern now. We try to run it responsibly to put the profits into worthwhile causes, and it's just growing and growing, growing at about 30-40% per year. So keeping up with that pace of growth means that we've got whopping great warehouses and lots of design teams and engineers and things working for us in different countries, and it's quite a big old boat to keep on the water, really.
Yeah. Now, you designed the Halti.
Yes, I did. That was, if you like, our first little venture into production and industry and so on, and that was a long time ago. It purely arose from, again, my useful contact as a farmer's son. How do you deal with a bull or a tricky horse? You put a halter on it, don't you? So I looked at designs of halters that were around and in the literature, and fashioned one literally out of baler cord for an Irish wolfhound called Ben, that I had to see the next day, and Ben was going to break my back because he was sort of 70-80 kilos of power, and boy I was amazed. So we tidied it up, and the Halti design was born, patented, protected, and we've sold, I think, 9, 10, 11 million, can't know precisely, but a lot. And, of course, other head collars have come along, different designs, but most people in the know still say that ours is the best, because it has the unique feature, an on-off muzzling action. So if you're dealing with aggressive dogs, and clearly if your dog just pulls, you can use an X, Y or Z other brand of head collar, but if it's an aggressive dog, ours closes the mouth and prevents him biting, which is really a big advantage. So but we've gone on, I've got a harness design which somewhat replicates the action of the Halti as a steering harness, and we've got, there's no pull harnesses and other gizmos that interrupt naughty behaviour. We're into reward based clicker training things, so we've got a range called the Clicks range of training equipment, and of course the Kong is fantastic. It's invented by a really, really good guy called Joe Markham in America, and he works in rubber, and he's just generated a whole range of useful interactive toys that stretch dogs' masticatory abilities and intellectual abilities. They have to solve problems to get at food that's stuffed inside. The actual stuffing of food in Kongs wasn't his idea, it was Ian Dunbar's again. So good old Ian, those of you who follow Ian's progress will know that he's not coming to England anymore for some reason. He doesn't like us. He just has completed his last lecture tour of England. in 2007, and we regret that very much, because he's a really, really talented and good guy.
Oh, yeah. Now, can we move on to your own dogs? Because...
Oh, no, you're going to reveal outrageous behaviour. Yap, yap, yap.
Reveal all about your dogs. How many dogs? Do you know how many dogs you actually have?
Do I know? Well, at the moment, I'm 5 dogs, but it has gone up to 9. And they're all second-hand dogs. I don't pay money for any of my dogs. Though PC beside me is probably the best known, and he features in all sorts of our products and does lots of TV with me. And he's a sort of scrainy little terrier that everyone thinks is a border terrier with short legs. But I say that he's a Rangoon terrier. And the story of the Rangoon terrier is that they were raised in India by the Rangoon Lancers, who walked across India. And they use them to protect their bayonets, shove a bayonet up their bum. And you know what? People believe me. And I say, look, there's a hole under a Rangoon Terrier's tail. And if you put your finger there, you see? It's where they put the bayonets up, right? And then when they came to London in the Victorian times, they used them as rodding drain dogs, because they eat at the front end. And you shove the rods up their back end, and you just push them down the drain, and they clear block drains. And you know, I have to say, this is terrible, in America, where people tend to believe that story. And I've had a good few people, oh, that's the Rangoon Terrier. I've heard of Rangoons, I've never met one. No, you're looking at the only one, the only Rangoon in the world that's left. Oh, that's so sad. So anyway, that's PC, and... I've got a border collie who works the sheep and cattle, but she's a sort of inheritance from a deceased Devon farmer cousin. And then I've got Humphrey, who's out of the court system. He spent a year in jail in his young days waiting his judgment, and his judgment came in court, in the Norwich Crown Court. Humphrey, stand up. With a black cap on, the judge said, you know, I condemn you to death. Alternatively, for the rest of your natural life, to live with Dr. Roger Mugford. Oh, thanks, Judge.
I don't know which is worse.
Yes. So Humphrey came to me, a fighter, a killer, so deprived. He had not had all the normal educational experiences. He went in at 7 months, came out at 19 months. And he was just terrible on the farm, wanted to chase and kill everything. And his only crime now is he still wants to kill the farm cat. But which isn't funny, actually. I mean, he's bad, bad with cats. But he's just, as you saw, the most adorable dog. And makes, you know, that type is a boxer cross staffy that looks like a pit bull and isn't a pit bull. But, you know, it sort of reinforces my belief that we must not characterise dogs by the way they look, only on the basis of what they do. And then I've got, of course, a rescue collie that you met yesterday. He came to me on Thursday, and he'll be found a home very quickly, I'm hoping, as a cancer detection dog, with the wonderful Claire Guest. So he won't be around very long. And then there's Harry, who is a black Labrador thing, and he's my girlfriend's. And then finally, there's Becky. And Becky is my lifelong servant, supporter, stalwart, my most favourite dog. And she never comes off the farm building. She's a protector. She's chased off many miscreants and trespassers. She can tell the difference between good and evil, foe and friend.
She's
so gorgeous, and she's 14 years old and a bit smelly now, but she'd still see off someone who hopped over the fence or a hedge. So she's fantastic. If you have a German Shepherd like that, they're so clever. But great dog. So that's about all my dogs. But in the past, I've had setters, and the setter fraternity know that, you know, I've always had a setter. So I'm feeling very deprived. And my greatest wish is one day when I grow up and know about dogs, I will have a pug. This pug to me, or the supreme sort of pinnacle of evolution of dogs, you see, because they're so like people.
I think that is the definition, though, of sort of taking your work home with you. You end up with all these dogs.
Yes, and of course the diversity of dogs. Notice there's no one theme running through the dogs I have or like. I love all dogs. And people who say, oh, I could never live with that, I don't know, border collie or whatever, they don't, you know, they become very breedist. And that, of course, that's wrong. The diversity of dogs, I would recommend people didn't have two of anything, so I'm sorry about this, but you've got two Labradors.
It was accidental, though,
It's, you know, have little and large, terrier and hound, and that sort of thing. Opposites work much better.
I think for most people, because you as you say, you go, I like Labradors or whatever it is. I know them. I like, well, short-coated breeds or whatever it is. Now, in our case, my daughter wanted a small dog. And I sort of thought, oh, I don't want a small dog. And she's beautiful.
Of course.
And she, as you said, but usually I think people, I mean, you've been thrown into sort of meeting all kinds of dogs, haven't you? So perhaps that's got to be where it, you know, comes from. But normally you sort of stick to what you know.
Yeah.
And you don't get that. But I think it must be the more dogs you meet, you just go, oh, yes, I do like them all. They're oral, because that's the nature of them.
Indeed. Even the good old English bulldog, for all the veterinary criticisms about their difficulties of breathing and so on, you know, I've known some really lovely ones of those. So, you know, but I don't like extremism. So we breeders, veterinarians and so on, we've got to still keep on improving our act in making dogs better. But I don't hold with some of the criticisms that occurred during this year's Crafts Dog Show, that breeders are being irresponsible and wicked and the Kennel Club is out of touch and so on. Dogs, generally speaking, are pretty healthy. The incidence of different diseases and behavioural problems does not systematically vary with the breed of dog. Otherwise, big companies like Pet Plan would vary their renewal fees by breed of dog. And, you know, you would have thought that some breeds, like, St. Bernard's, say, would be more prone to orthopaedic problems than Whippets or Greyhounds, and that they would charge more to insure St. Bernard, but no, they don't. And it's just the same in my behavioural area. There is no one breed that's disaster for breeds. Any dog can have a problem. And I would like to say on air, if this is on air, that it is not all the fault of owners. Problems arise by mistakes, by accidents, by sometimes clinical medical disease that affects behaviour. The biggest, the most important priority in my work is to not let people feel guilty about the fact that they're seeking help and that they are having problems. It can happen to us or to any of us. Perfect timing.
Clearly, Star agreed with Roger's views. Roger is committed to and passionate about dogs, as well as, I'm sure you could tell, being great fun to talk to. The Company of Animals offers some fantastic products that have been well designed and tried and tested and really work. Buddy adored one of their latest toys, the Kong Wubber, which he wouldn't be parted from and carried around with him. I do recommend you check out the website and let your dog have some fun too. There is sorrow enough in the natural way for men and women to fill our day. But when we are certain of sorrow in store, why do we always arrange for more? Brothers and sisters, I bid you beware of giving your heart to a dog to tear. Rudyard Kipling. Stephen Pam, host of Hound TV, had almost definitely travelled the furthest to attend Train and Behave because he flew in from Australia. It was good to finally meet up, and we mulled over some dog-related stories that have been in the news recently.
So I'm here reviewing the papers with Stephen Pam from Hound TV. And you do
the Hound TV intro. Hi, this is Stephen from Hound TV, the world's first video podcast for dogs and their owners. How's that?
Oh, yes, you did it much better than I would have done. And it's me from Dogcast.
Well, this is a great thrill, Julie. This is certainly the furthest we've been on official Hound TV duty. So, what is it, 20,000 miles or something? So
It's above and beyond the call of duty, really, isn't it? But it's nice to actually meet you finally.
It's great. It's great. So I've been travelling around on trains a fair bit while I've been here and picking up newspapers. And in the last few days, I've found a few stories that I thought I'd share with you and we could tell the listeners about.
Yeah.
The first one's not so nice. It's about there's a tradition in Korea of... This is from the Independent. Mm-hmm. And there's a tradition in Korea of eating dog meat as part of some sort of festival. It doesn't really explain here, but apparently the day's called Malbok, which is one of 3 days on the lunar calendar when the Koreans consume most of the 100,000 tons of dog meat that they eat every year.
It's a lot of... I wonder how much that translates to in actual dogs.
It does say here somewhere, I think, but it's loads. Anyway, here we go. Well, this is how many dogs... The true picture suggests that dog eating is still rife in Korea. In 2002, according to the National Statistical Office, 2.95 million dogs were slaughtered in Korea for food. So that's quite amazing, isn't it? So apparently amongst people under 30, Koreans under 30, it's less popular. And they showed that the a survey showed that 59% of Koreans aged under 30 would not eat dogs, which still leaves 41% that would. So
it does. That's yes.
Yeah.
But
yeah. So
the bit that struck me was where, I mean, personally, okay, it's a cultural thing, but personally, eating dog meat is not pleasant. It's distasteful. But worse than that, there's something called gay soju, liquefied dog. Marinated in herbs and consumed as a drink or soup.
Now, that does not sound too appealing, does it?
No, no. You can still get in on it even if you haven't got teeth. You can drink it.
Right. Right. I wonder if they sell it in, like, fast food joints. Anyway. Actually, I'd be interested to get some... to see what listeners think and get some feedback in the comments, particularly from listeners that are... Well, if you're vegetarian or if you're not vegetarian or if you're a vegan and how that would affect your view on this. Because if you eat, you know, cow and sheep and chicken and other animals, is there anything different about eating dogs if they're killed humanely, if they're raised and killed humanely, which we don't know what the situation in Korea is. Likewise, if you're a vegetarian, I suppose you wouldn't have an issue about it. But yeah, I'd be interested to know what people think. So
As a vegetarian, it's just, I mean, it is all, I don't like, I mean, I'm not in the militant wing, and I, you know, if you want to eat meat, that's fine. But to me, because I have dogs that live in my house that I love, you know, it is more horrific to me than just eating, you know, your more traditional animals, you know, as you said, your cows, but then that's just a cultural thing. So it would be interesting to hear from any listeners in Korea, you know, that have grown up with this or that think this is, you know, this is okay, it's just part of their culture.
It mentions in the story as well that younger people did see, consider dogs as, they regard dogs as pets rather than food as well. So I guess that dogs are kept as pets in Korea as well. So it's an interesting situation.
Now, we're going to move on to a very expensive pet, aren't we?
Yes.
Allegedly.
Now, according to Metro, which is one of the free London papers, London afternoon papers, wealthy Chinese are paying up to £250,000, which is about the price of a small house here, for a dog that sells for £850 here in Britain, which is the Tibetan Mastiff. Now, it doesn't give a source here, so we don't know if this is substantiated or if this is just rumour-mongering. But, apparently there's a bit of a Tibetan craze going on in China at the moment, and people are willing to pay this sort of money for Tibetan Mastiffs, which I imagine would be a bit concerning if you owned one, that you might be worried that the triads were going to come over and kidnap it or something.
Could be. Also, I mean, is it going to send the price up here if they go up there? Our breeder's going to sort of think, okay, if we can get that kind of price.
Yeah, well, you would think so. There would be opportunities to export them to China.
Also, what strikes me is, you know, I mean, can I just point out, 250,000, maybe a small house in London. It could be a mansion somewhere else. It
yeah,
could be a
region, right, right.
You know, so
and
that
also,
is a very London-centric.
And also, when you take the Chinese average income into account as well, I mean... Yeah, obviously.
But that would be more for them.
Exactly.
Yeah,
I mean, there wouldn't be many people that would have that sort of money to spend on a dog here, let alone in China.
No. So. But I mean, the fact that kind of money is being paid for dogs when we have dogs just, you know, crying out for a good home,
right?
And
right.
In shelters, that is just.
It's quite bizarre, isn't it?
Yeah.
So I would take this one with a grain of salt. But if anyone knows anything more about that, then perhaps they could. Drop you a line or leave a comment as well.
Yeah.
Be interested to hear if anyone knows anything more about that, but did just catch my eye on the train.
And another one that caught your eye.
And finally, as they say.
We're going to move on to a very happy story, aren't we, that Newfoundlands, which are gorgeous, they're big shaggy dogs and they love the water. And in Italy, now this is a story in The Independent, in Italy they're actually using them for water rescue, but actually jumping out of helicopters to rescue people drowning in the sea.
Now, this I would like to see. We might have to make a trip to Italy to cover this story, I think.
That could be our next junket.
Yeah, I think so. We've just got to find a very deep-pocketed sponsor to send us, don't
we? Yes, please.
So, Purina One, if you're listening. Aren't they owned by Nestle? They've got plenty of money.
Yeah. It doesn't have to be dog-related. We'll just, you know,
well, that's
just want
right.
Money.
Could be anyone. Nike, whatever.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so they're training these Newfoundlands and also a few Labradors, I think, at the Italian Dog Rescue School to jump out of helicopters and save drowning people. And apparently the dogs are they can be used in situations where a human rescuer wouldn't be able to, where it wouldn't be safe for a human rescuer to do that job.
Because they are very powerful in the water, aren't they? I remember seeing, we met a group of Newfoundland trainers doing water training, and they don't swim like other dogs. I remember them saying, if you can see them underwater.
Okay, I've never seen one swim. I'm always amazed that dogs can swim at all. Because, you know, like when we swim, we lie flat in the water, and we've got quite a large surface area on our hands and feet. Yeah. And dogs have got those, you know, stick-type legs, and they don't have particularly large feet. So I'm always amazed that they can propel themselves in the water at all.
I think Newfies have webbed...
Right.
Feet, web paws.
Let's check that out. Anyone from the Newfoundland Club?
Yes.
Drop us a line.
You could verify that. We're right. Is it Stansted Airport?
Heathrow. We're about 5 miles from Heathrow Airport,
yes.
I think. So
you can hear the planes.
Yeah, that was the 11:05 to somewhere.
But, I mean, they are incredibly powerful, and we've seen them tow boats out of the water.
Right, okay.
They really are. And, I mean, I can quite see where they would just jump in and sort of love it and think, this is great, and it wouldn't be work for them. They'd be like, yay, this is rough and this is great, you know, and have a good swim. And the only thing that does strike me is, if you're in trouble already and you're in the sea and, you know, things aren't going well, if you're not particularly a doggy person, seeing a great, huge,
you might get a fright, yeah.
Coming as well.
Yeah. Well, I presume they've researched all of this, because this is obviously a pretty expensive exercise with helicopters and all the rest of it. So it is interesting and be good to find out a bit more about it. And perhaps we'll see if we can track down the Newfoundland people back home and see if they know anything about it.
I'd like to know, so the first time they jump out of the helicopter, do they sort of get the helicopter? Well, I suppose you start with not a helicopter, don't you? You start with sort of a platform and get them to jump and sort of gradually take it up.
Take them higher, and then you'd have to get them accustomed to going in helicopters.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, it'd be quite involved training a dog in that environment, wouldn't it?
Because I get the feeling, like, there's any dogs that would do this. Humans be like, are you kidding?
Yeah.
Are you kidding? But dogs,
why would I jump out of a perfectly good helicopter?
Stephen, it's been great fun meeting you and discussing these stories.
Thanks, Julie. It's been a pleasure to be over here.
Good.
I hope you enjoyed our news review. Our usual news team of Kate and Nick will be back in our next episode with the regular Dogcast Radio news. To listen to and watch Stephen Pam, follow our Hound TV link. His name is not Wild Dog anymore, but the First Friend, because he will be our friend for always and always and always. Rudyard Kipling. We all want our dogs to have the best life they possibly can, and our next interview will help you ensure that happens. Dog lover and author Jason Rich shares his life with Rusty, his Yorkshire Terrier, and has written Pampering Your Pooch, Discover What Your Dog Wants, Needs and Loves. Each chapter of the book focuses on a different way to pamper your dog. But don't misunderstand the word pamper.
Basically, the concept was, you know, I adopted my dog Rusty when he was a puppy, and I was started to spend a lot of money on him, on a bunch of different, you know, extravagant things. And, you know, I was having a lot of fun with it, but, you know, some of the stuff I was buying for him wasn't necessarily good for him and his well-being. You know, it was more, you know, me in terms of designer labels or whatever. So when I started doing this book, you know, I did a lot of research, and, you know, the whole focus of the book is how to pamper your dog and give him the best of everything, but everything that's in his best interest and in that for the health and well-being of the dog, not necessarily the owner. And a perfect example of that is, you know, it's great if you have a small dog and you want to buy, you know, a nice designer carrier for the dog, but it's very important that the carrier be well-made, be well ventilated, be sturdy, you know, and be comfortable for the dog, as opposed to being a fashion statement for the dog's owner. You know, it's great to carry a Louis Vuitton, you know, dog carrier if you're into labels, you know. However, if your dog doesn't fit in that Louis Vuitton case, you shouldn't be, you know, smushing them in there.
No.
And making the dog uncomfortable.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, the whole focus of the book is, you know, how to, you know, treat your dog to the best of everything, you know, again, with the health and well-being of the dog in mind.
Yeah, yeah. Now, let's jump in then to an area that's very important, as you say, from your dog's point of view. Toys and activities, entertaining your dog. What ideas have you got for us for that?
I looked at a whole bunch of what you would, I guess you would call educational toys, for the dog. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's a lot of fun stuff out there where, you know, the dog is, his mind is challenged as well as, you know, the actual, you know, physical, you know, activity for the dog. You know, every dog just likes to play fetch, you know, so it's, you can buy, you know, spend all kinds of money on, you know, fancy toys for your dog, but if you go outside and grab a stick, he's going to have just as much fun with that stick as he is going to have with a $50 toy.
Yeah.
You know, but I found, you know, a lot of toys where, you know, you can stick the treat inside and it's like a puzzle for the dog where they, you know, they chase it around and they push it and they, you know, they try and get the treat out. Things like that are a lot of fun, and it does challenge the dog.
Yeah,
you know, but when it comes right down to it, again, you know, you want to focus on what the dog is really going to enjoy and what's going to, you know, occupy his mind, and that's very different for every single dog.
Mm-hmm. It's funny you say that because we have three dogs, and two we've had from puppies, and one is a retired guide dog we just adopted, and the two that have lived with us from puppyhood love Kongs and, you know, the treat balls and all that kind of thing. And I got them out recently and sort of, you know, to occupy them. And the guide dog, who is 10, just kind of nosed the thing around for a while and then looked at me like, well, this is stupid. There's food in there and I can't get to it.
You know, one thing I found, with Rusty, my dog, as well as, you know, talking to a lot of other dog owners, is you should rotate the dog's toys every couple months. You know, they're always going to have one or two of their favorite toys, which they want around with them, you know, all the time. Like, Rusty has this little stuffed animal that looks like a human. It looks like a cookie bread dog. I mean, a cookie bread doll. And he carries that everywhere. But, you know, every month or so, I just rotate the toys out to give him a little change of scenery. Because I find that, you know, he'll play with something for a couple weeks, and then he'll just be bored with it for a while.
Mm.
You know, so I swap it out with something else that he really enjoys. And then, you know, a couple months later, I swap that, you know, bring in that old toy again. And, you know, as far as he's concerned, it's something brand new.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, so that's a really good tip, you know, for dog owners. If they, you know, if you want to buy a lot of toys for your dog, don't just, you know, give him the whole toy chest. You know, pick two or three toys at a time, let them play with it for a couple weeks, then rotate it out. Again, always, you know, give them one or two toys that are just always around that are their favorites. But then, you know, with the other toys, rotate them. And, you know, that seems to work really well with dogs.
That's a brilliant idea. Now, another section, which obviously is going to be important for owners and dogs, is what we feed them with. And you've got your food and you've got treats. So what ideas, what can you give us there?
Well, one thing, you know, I did, again, a lot of research for this book, and I found that a lot of the, you know, the inexpensive dog foods that you buy at supermarkets are not really that good for your dog. You know, there's a lot of additives, a lot of chemicals, a lot of preservatives that over time, you know, can actually make your dog sick. You know, so, you know, what I found is you want to go for a slightly higher-end dog food brand where there's no preservatives, no additives, and it's all natural food. And, you know, I listed a couple in the book. You know, I personally, you know, feed Rusty, my dog, Inova, both the kibbles as well as the canned food. And it's, you know, extremely well-made, all, you know, really all natural ingredients. And it's only about 20% more than supermarket food. And when you have a small dog who eats next to nothing anyway, it's maybe $3 extra a month to feed your dog really healthy food. And I, you know, when I first got him, I was feeding him a supermarket brand food. And then I, you know, transferred him over after about 6 months when I started learning about these higher end foods. And within 2 weeks, I noticed his eyes were clearer. His fur was shinier and richer. He had more energy and he was just like a healthier dog. And, you know, so you will definitely see a dramatic effect on your dog, after just 2 weeks of feeding them a better quality food.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the trick is look at the labels, look at what's in the food. And if, you know, there's a lot of stuff you just don't understand and a lot of chemicals and a lot of preservatives, you don't want to feed that to your dog. Mm. And, you know, the other thing you should do is stick to the dog's, you know, stick to his food. You know, don't feed him a lot of table scraps and a lot of, you know, people food mixed with the dog food. You know, like Rusty eats Innova, and I throw in a couple, you know, carrots, you know, real, you know, raw carrots, and, you know, a few other things that are go into his bowl. But, you know, he never eats off the table, never gets leftovers or anything.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's a very healthy dog as a result of that and has a lot of energy. And you can just see it that, you know, in his eyes and, you know, in his coat and everything, just that, you know, how healthy he is. And it's a result of just a really good diet. And in talking to, you know, a bunch of veterinarians, you know, I learned that just by feeding your dog, you know, a healthy diet, you could extend their life by 3 to 5 years.
Wow.
And just as they get older, they'll have a lot less medical bills. And they won't need to go to the vet as much, you know, for various, you know, common diseases that are, you know, basically caused by a bad diet. You know, dogs, you know, down the road have a lot of teeth problems, and that could lead to, like, a whole bunch of other medical problems. And, you know, just by feeding them healthy food and taking care of their teeth, you can, you know, prevent a lot of stuff, you know, later in life. You know, and make your dog's, you know, entire life a lot happier and a lot healthier.
Yeah, yeah. When I first got Buddy and we were doing our first classes, I won't name the food, but there was a particular food that, there was a bearded collie dog, and he was on this particular food, and he was wild. And the trainer said, just take him off that, put him onto something else, just get him off that particular food. And again, just behaviour-wise, you could see the difference in this dog. It is vital, isn't it?
Definitely. And, you know, it's very easy. You know, a lot of the, you know, if you go to some of the higher end dog, you know, pet supply stores, you know, that are independently owned, they tend to carry the better food brands, you know, like the Innovas or so, you know, or something, you know, that have the all natural ingredients. And it's not too much more money, and you're going to ultimately you're going to save a lot of money, you know, on vet bills and, you know, on the care of your dog just by feeding him a healthy diet. And you will, you know, as I said, within 2 weeks, you will see a difference.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, the same goes for treats also. There's, you know, a lot of supermarket treats out there that are just not good for your dog. They're coated in chemicals and have, you know, all the stuff that you don't really want your dog eating. And a lot of it can be choking hazards and whatever. You know, so, it, you know, just by doing a little research and finding, you know, the all-natural treats that don't have, you know, the negative, you know, chemicals and additives and preservatives and all that stuff, you know, again, you'll be treating your dog to something he really likes, but also taking care of his health and well-being at the same time. And, you know, just, you know, I try, you know, tried a bunch of different treats, you know, with Rusty, and, you know, I found, like, you know, the Zooks all-natural mini treats, which are great for training. They're not too expensive, and you can get them on the Zooks website. He loves them, and, you know, I've talked to a lot of other dog owners who have tried it, and they've had, you know, some very similar results. You know, Rusty will do just about anything for one of these little treats. And, you know, again, they're all natural and they're healthy. You know, so I don't feel bad giving them a couple of them, you know, that, you know, every so often.
Yeah, yeah. You're making it sound like a Scooby snack now.
Yeah, basically. As far as he's concerned, that's pretty much what it is.
Yeah. Now, you've mentioned health and visits to the vet and things. Now, this is one area where often, you know, you say health insurance, be prepared for emergencies, and often people just aren't prepared and the worst happens and, you know, they're suddenly faced with a bill. How do you cope with it? So...
Yeah, I mean, you know, basically, you know, I am, you know, just in general in my life, you know, I believe in insurance.
Yeah.
And, you know, so as soon as I, you know, adopted Rusty, I got him, you know, the pet insurance. But before you just sign up for pet insurance, you want to do a little research to find out what's going to be covered and understand it. Pet insurance is really for, you know, emergencies. If the dog breaks a limb or if he gets really sick or needs an operation, that's when it's going to cover, you know, a lot of the medical treatments and save you a lot of money. For, you know, the annual, you know, physicals and, you know, the average medications or whatever that they just, you know, that they're normally going to run into, you're not going to save a lot of money.
No.
Like when I had him neutered, it cost me, I think it was like almost $600.
Wow.
And the insurance only covered about $200 for it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so some things, you know, it's going to help a lot with, like if, you know, Rusty breaks a leg, for example, you know, you could have $2,000 to $3,000 in medical bills,
yeah.
You know, where insurance would cover, I think it's 80% of that. You know, so that can save you a lot of money, and you don't have to worry about where am I going to come up with this money to just, you know, to decide what type of treatment he's going to get. You know, just by, you know, for $30 a month, it's peace of mind.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's definitely a really good investment, just so you know that if anything were to happen to him, you know, I can get him the very best medical care, you know, all the latest treatments and whatever, and not have to worry about, you know, going into debt or going bankrupt as a result.
Yeah, yeah. And I think as well, another tip is sort of start that early on. Don't wait until there's problems. Get that insurance
definitely.
In place.
The younger you start, the cheaper the insurance is going to be because your rate will stay the same. You know, so if you start your dog, you know, with insurance as a puppy, it's going to be under $30 a month, and that will stay the same for the life of the dog.
Mm.
Where if you try and insure a 5 or 10 year old dog, it's going to be much more expensive. Just like if you're getting health insurance for a person.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. Now, some of the advice in your book is obviously very practical, but you've got some other advice that's sort of. Perhaps one wouldn't expect in a dog book, because we've got dog massage and pet psychics, so far so good, Zen and the art of pampering your pooch. So tell us about that one.
Well, basically, I wanted to, you know, talk about every aspect of pampering your dog, and, you know, including, you know, pet psychics and massage therapy and everything, because, you know, people are really interested in that.
Mm.
And, I did, through the research, I found that, you know, dog massage, you know, can help. It can keep the dog calm. It's a way of bonding with the dog. You know, there are benefits, just like when people get a massage. You know, it's a very relaxing sensation.
Hmm.
And, you know, pet psychics, you know, if you believe in it, that's great. You know, I'm not going to say I believe in it or not. You know, it's up to the individual. You know, if you go to a fortune teller or a tarot card reader, or if you go to a pet psychic. I mean, I talked to a couple of them. You know, some of them seem somewhat credible, and some of them didn't. You know, and, you know, basically, if there's a person charging an exorbitant amount of money, hundreds and hundreds of dollars, or, you know, euros for a telephone reading where they don't even need to see the dog, I would be a little worried about that.
Mm.
If you're going to get involved with the pet psychic, you know, just be very careful that you're not being conned. And if you want to look into the, you know, dog massage or, you know, massage therapy for the dog, find someone who's trained. You know, a lot of the people who are offering, there's no license for dog massage, massage therapist for dogs. However, a lot of people who are licensed to do, you know, human massages also do dogs, and that's how they get into the business. So if you find someone who knows, you know, who's been trained in massage and physical therapy and stuff, you know, that could be very good for the dog.
It definitely can be very calming, can't it? Definitely.
Definitely. And, you know, the massage therapist can actually teach the dog owner some basic massage techniques, so, you know, the owner can work with their own dog. And that could be a great bonding experience.
Mm.
You know, so, like, you know, while you're watching TV, the dog can sit on your lap or sit next to you on the floor or whatever, and, you know, you could do some basic massage, and it's, you know, it's really enjoyable for the dog, and it's a way for, you know, the human to bond with their dog in a very calming, you know, relaxing way.
Yeah, yeah. Now, another problem for many people is sort of, what do you do with your dog if you have to go out to work? So you've got training, doggy daycare and resorts, and a very important message, a trained and entertained dog is a happy dog.
Definitely. Doggy daycare is a great thing. However you want to find the perfect place to bring your dog. You know, you want to make sure that your dog is getting very, you know, personalized attention, that they're actually monitoring the dogs, especially if the dogs can be interacting with other dogs.
Mm.
You know, dogs love playing with other dogs for the most part. You know, and doggy daycare offers, you know, supposedly offers a supervised place. You know, so you want to make sure that the place is legit, that they're going to take care of your dog, and that they're going to offer, you know, supervision by, a, you know, someone who is knowledgeable on how to interact with dogs to keep your dog safe and, you know, well-fed and supervised. You know, but, you know, there are dogs who actually look forward to doggy daycare because it's, you know, a place for them to run around, have fun with other dogs.
Mm.
You know, because a lot of owners don't like going out running with their dog and giving the dog the freedom to, you know, to actually burn off the energy they have.
Mm.
You know, so doggy daycare is a great way to do that, and it's a great alternative to leaving them home alone. You know, personally, I've used doggy daycare at times when I've traveled, but, when I travel, I like to bring Rusty along. I purposely got a small dog who can travel with me on the plane. And, you know, Rusty loves to travel. He loves hanging out in hotels and stuff.
Yeah.
You know, but, you know, I try and avoid just leaving him for long periods of time alone.
I guess that's the ultimate pampering for your dog, isn't it? Actually spending time with them.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, a dog, you know, as I said, you go back to the basics. The dog likes nothing more than to spend time with its owner and to play very basic games. The dogs want attention. You know, you don't have to do these extravagant, exciting things with your dog. You know, I've made a point, you know, when I travel to take my dog, you know, on tours and stuff. Like, you know, the dog has seen the White House, and I've taken it to Venice Beach and in L.A. and, you know, all this stuff. The dog just likes going out running. He doesn't care if he's running around the block or running along Venice Beach or, you know, or Malibu or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, they just like spending time running around playing. You know, so you want to, you know, go back to basics. You know, spend time with your dog and do the things that he seems to like. You know, if most dogs love playing fetch. Rusty can play fetch for, you know, a half hour, hour at a time and, you know, and not get bored. The human gets bored throwing the same stick, but dogs like that. And you want to remember that, you know, when you're spending time and trying to pamper your dog, always think about what the dog likes. You know, what is your dog going to enjoy? What's going to be in the best interest of your dog? And what's going to, you know, what are they going to like, but what are they going to be, what's going to keep them healthy? You know, so whether you're buying dog clothes or a carrier or, you know, the dog food or whatever, you just want to make sure that the dog is being well taken care of and, you know, that there's no way he can be injured or, you know, or hurt in any way as a result of your, quote, pampering him.
Now, there's obviously many, many, many more ideas and suggestions in the book than we can cover now. So
yep.
Where can people find out more about your book and about you?
You can find out about me on my website, which is jasonrich.com. Rusty, my dog, who's a Yorkshire Terrier, has his own website, which is mypalrusty.com. And the book, which is called Pampering Your Pooch, is available from bookstores and from Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com. And, you know, it's not a dog training book, and I want to make that very clear. Dog training is very different than pampering your dog. So I am not a dog trainer, and this is not a book on how to train your dog. It's a book about how to have fun with your dog and keep the dog's health and well-being in mind. You know, so you're still going to need to go to training and work with a trainer if you want your dog trained. But this, you know, this book is loaded with information about great products and services that you might want to use with your dog to enhance their life. And, you know, that's what it's all about.
It certainly is what it's all about. Some really great ideas there. Something for every dog owner. And if you want to set about pampering your pooch, there are links on the Dogcast Radio site to Jason's site, his dog Rusty's site, and of course, the Pamper Your Dog book site. Buy a pup, and your money will buy love unflinching. Rudyard Kipling. Larry Merrill contacted us about his website, dogeachday.com. Larry celebrated the Chinese Year of the Dog by drawing and posting a dog each day. Larry received submissions of photos and wonderful stories to accompany each entry from across the globe. The website was updated each day with new dog art and usually a short narrative. The site is now in rewind mode, where it's displaying the dog for 1 year ago today. The artwork on display here is beautiful, and on the Dogcast Radio site, you can see some of Larry's work, a drawing of his first dog, Duffy, as a pup. I hope you've enjoyed our second anniversary show. If you've been with us from the start, thank you. If not, you've got some catching up to do. There's our first 47 shows to listen to. We've had a brilliant 2 years finding out about anything and everything dog-related and meeting some wonderful dogs and people along the way. Till next time, look after yourselves and your dogs.
Thanks for listening to Dogcast Radio, available from www.dogcastradio.com. That's dogcastradio.com. If you'd like to get in touch with us, and wherever you are in the world, we'd love to hear from you. You can do so in a variety of ways. By phone from the UK, you can contact us on 0121-288-0922. From the US, you can contact us on our American number, which is 315-849-2022. From any other country, you'll need your international exit code and then 44 021-288-0922. You can contact us on Skype with the ident Dogcast Radio. That's all one word, Dogcast Radio. By email, you can contact me on julie@dogcastradio.com. When contacting us by email, if you have the facilities, please record your questions or comments and send them to us as an audio file. That way we can include them directly in our programme. We can accept most formats, for example, WAV, MP3. All these methods of contacting us can be found on our website, which is www.dogcastradio.com. And as ever, the final word goes to Jenny.
How do you know when you've got a slow dog? He brings you yesterday's paper.